It's done Baptist style.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And good to have you with us here. I want you to join us at 410-319-8888. Let me set this up as we open and introduce our panelists to you all. You know, some of you saw the events in Greece and think they may have nothing to do with what's happening here in Baltimore with housing policy or government taking away another $28 million for public housing in Baltimore or lack of respect and racism inside our police departments or transparency or accountability or what Confederate flags and monuments stand for in our society or the symbolism of their removal doesn't really change the substantive issues of race and poverty that they represent. It all appears so disparate. But I think in a larger social economic context, they are deeply connected. Greece is a thread in the great unraveling. The systems we live under cannot answer the questions, apparently, of housing for people. In Baltimore alone, there are 86,000 families that are home insecure. Over one half of our population lives in poverty. And the government seems to have no answer. So that unraveling is felt here as well. And as you know, as many times as I've said it, I believe we live in a nation where race and racism are in the tissue and marrow of our being. And that is unraveling as well. We can ban the Confederate battle flag but not answer the questions of housing, unemployment, and the future of our schools. The black church is symbolic of the struggle for freedom and equality, so it's attacked with ferocity by the most extreme elements. It must be defended, not tolerated, and that extreme racism has to be called out. But while we focus on the extremes, the political corporate establishment takes away money for housing, moves people from their homes and communities, and continues to punish and incarcerate. So we're going to try to wrestle with what those contradictions mean and where they take us, and what we should be talking about and battling for. So we want you to join the conversation here at 410-319-8888. Once again, in the studio with me is Reverend Todd Yeary, senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Church and leading community activist. Good to see you again, Todd.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Eugene Craig III is with us.
Let's appreciate it.
Grassroots activist, third vice chair of the Maryland Republican State Party. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Do I call you chair?
No. Just call me Gene.
Good to have you in the studio. Welcome. And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is on her way and will be here shortly to join the conversation here. But you all please join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, get onto our Facebook pages. But do call 410-319-8888. So, Todd, appreciate it. I know at the last minute I called and you said you could make it in here today, so
I love coming to hang out with you.
This is good. I like it, too. So let's begin then. I mean, I think that, you know, when we see also in this morning's Sun, there was Baltimore Sun, there was an interesting editorial that was written by the paper itself about the Court of Special Appeals decision we just talked about, Bob Bell, about saying that personal records cannot block anybody from knowing what happened to a police officer who used racial epithets against a woman who called seeking some help. And it was interesting, only the two black jurists on that court were the ones who had dissenting opinion. And then there's a really interesting piece in here by Connor Meek, who I do not know. I don't think I know him. But it was an op-ed about what happened to him when he tried to go to the police department at 7 o'clock to tell about his bike being stolen in Leakin Park. And then the police officer got there, had his arm at the door, was very rude to him and said, "We're closed." Because they close from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Citizens can't walk in.
So, wow.
So, we're closed. Todd?
Yeah. Where do you begin? Where do you begin with that? I think let's start with the access to records of offending officers. That's a question. How do we know? And if we don't know as the public, would the chain of command know? How is it that we find officers being able to stay in the job for extended periods of time, knowing that some of them have had some violations? And if you don't have checks and balances where there is an outside observer making sure that the system is working properly and those who are tasked with impacting people's liberty are doing it appropriately, mm-hmm. I think that's very problematic. I think in light of the ruling, it warrants then that we now go back to the other end of it and ask the General Assembly, fix it. Fix it legislatively so that in the course of ensuring that the interest of the public, the citizens and residents of the state are protected, that by law there ought to be a mechanism by which those records should be able to be obtained. And so while it's unfortunate, I think it just means we have to go back and reset the conversation about how we approach it and fix it. Now, you know, the police department being closed, that's a whole other matter. You can get a lot of joke levity out of that, because some would say it's not just 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. when it comes to their issues and interests being addressed. Any time of the day, depending on who you are, some might say that they're not getting the due attention that they would want from the police officers, and that's another structural issue that we have to look at. So I think it's symbolic. It's the real-time experience of one person, but I think it speaks volumes about the experiences of a whole lot more who haven't really had the opportunity to tell their story.
No, I think that it was obviously an interesting piece that was written. That's why I raised it. I mean, it's just symbolic of something so much more deeper. And I'm curious your thoughts on similar things, Eugene.
You know, I think the legislature at this point does need to go back and, you know, deal with some records law. I think it's a lot more than just, you know, police records. You know, we have a lot of convoluted records laws when it comes to public records here in the state of Maryland. More so in the police. I will say this. You would not have seen the uprising that we saw in West Baltimore after the Freddie Gray death. If, you know, people felt as though their police department was open 24 hours a day and, you know, a part of the community. And so I do think, you know, that was one person's anecdotal experience, but I think it's representative of a much broader experience throughout the entire city.
Kimberly, good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I think, but what does have to be done? I mean, so when we talk, let's just begin in this place here, because we are seeing in the news a great deal here in Baltimore right now about the what I've just mentioned, but the mayor and the police commissioner saying they're going to go after all the videos they can find to go after the young people who were in the streets during the uprising after Freddie Gray's death, to push those prosecutions. And we see that happening on the hills. There's still real confusion about who gave orders or did not give orders to stand down.
Yeah.
To who is actually what kind of response we're going to have, and when Todd Yeary calls Kimberly for the state legislature to have to respond to this, I mean I see this as one of the big brewing battles coming up in this session over police accountability and what citizens' rights are and how we come mm-hmm. to a place where we deal with the race and racism and more. I mean this could be a battleground. I'm curious your thoughts
on
this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said this last week when we were having this continued conversation, that we're still in a space where there's a lot of scapegoating going on, and we're looking to place blame on someone because we do want answers and we want some kind of resolution to what has taken place, when unfortunately our elected officials, as well as those who have been appointed to their positions, still aren't willing to take the responsibility. And that, to me, almost becomes, in, you know, if you look at it as a 12-step process, right, or as a 12-step program similar to what we do with Alcoholics Anonymous,
yeah,
that's one of the first steps of being able to move forward, is for us to say, okay, mistake made, we understand, but let's move forth as a community. And no one seems to be willing to do so. And I think that's what keeps us in this quagmire, where there's a lot of projecting upon who we believe is responsible, but yet no one seems to want to take on the blame. And that leaves us in the same space that we've been in since the uprising happened in well over 6 weeks ago.
So, mate, it feels as if we're at an interesting historical cusp. It just feels that way. Maybe we'll find out after I'm gone whether or not that's true.
I'll be around for it.
You'll be around.
We're going to do it before you go.
Y'all might be around, but in 20 years, I don't know. We'll see what happens. It'd be cool if I did, but anyway. So the question being that we're seeing these uprisings across the country. We're seeing Black Lives Matter. We're seeing now the move against the Confederate flag and Confederate monuments, which we can talk about because it's symbolically they're important, but there's greater depth than just those symbols. But we are at a place where there's a push for change. And I don't see the push as coming only from the Black community. I think the push is happening across the board in America, which is mm-hmm. everything you see a demonstration. It's this multiracial coalition of people out in the street who are saying something has to change, which I think is a step forward for this country to see that.
Absolutely.
But what does it mean politically? I mean, how do we get to that point? I've asked both When the congressmen were on the show the other week, two congressmen and a congresswoman were on the show the other week, and then I had some state delegates on the program just last week, I asked the same question. I said, have you ever thought that maybe your houses need to have a conversation about race, racism, and poverty in America and what that means? I mean, so we're at this cusp. So what is that? What do you think that takes us politically? I mean, you walk the halls all the time down in Annapolis. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, have a sense of that place because you're there all the time lobbying and pushing for things.
Well, I think part of our challenge is we don't like the R word. We yeah. talk about words.
You don't mean Republican. You mean
no, no.
I'm just teasing.
No. Really good guys.
The issue of having a conversation about race starts with having to wrestle with personal guilt, when in reality, racism at its core is structural. Mm-hmm. The structure then coerces loyalty to the structure because there is an apportionment of benefits to some as opposed to others on the basis of that skin color. And so the loyalties that you see are tied to the fact that there's something in it for me. And so for us to change this conversation around race, the conversation about privilege has to come up, because very often we deflect and try to make it a conversation about class, but class cannot be a full conversation unless race is tied to it. They are inextricably linked, and if you're going to have a conversation about race, you got to bring the P word into it, so you got to talk about poverty, and then you have to start looking at those other structural issues. To the point that was made is that the Freddie Gray uprising, the resistance, was triggered by the police response. But I think the underlying issues that we have to deal with to avoid coming back to this place are the issues of housing, healthcare, education, economic empowerment, and access to capital. If we don't talk about those structural conversations and look at the influence that race has on how those things are carried out, then we are just biding our time until we find ourselves back with the next Freddie Gray.
Yeah, I can't agree more. And I think, I don't know if it's this, you know, kumbaya diversity seminar moment that needs to be had with our politicians, but it's clear that these are real conversations that need to happen. And I think what we find ourselves so committed to is seeing racism as these individual acts or attacks on other individuals, that we look at ourselves and say, but we don't do that, so we then are not racist. But the reality is, we are talking very much about a structure, and it's a structure that is so inherent in our society that it also breeds us to carry out individual acts, such as our implicit biases. Right? I mean, so as I tell my students every semester, that they walk in the classroom and by virtue of where they congregate and sit and who they sit with, I make certain observations about who they are. That's my implicit bias of what I have towards the student athletes or towards those who think they're smarter than me in the classroom. I already have that in my head as an implicit bias. So I find it hard to believe that we then can't see that being transposed upon race issues, where by virtue of everything that we're exposed to in media, our interpersonal relationships and interactions, that we then have an implicit bias against certain groups of people based on that information. And so that is the piece that has to be dealt with in order to even move forth, is to look at yourself and say, what are my implicit biases towards particular groups of people? Why is it that I can lash out on this group of people when I call it containing or controlling or policing a situation, but yet I buy Burger King for somebody else who has killed 9 people and made it very clear that it is about race? There's a way that we look upon groups of people that allows us to carry out certain acts like that and then say, hide behind the shield of, I'm just protecting the public. But that's not protecting the public fully. That is choosing based on our implicit bias how we then look upon people and how we believe they need to be treated.
You know, make a couple points. The first one, the best way to protect the public is equal justice protection under the law. You know, and I think that should be the basis of everything, especially when it comes to government. Politics is largely reactionary. Every major political move, every major political program, anything, most big things that you see come out of Congress, come out of the State House, our reactions to a massive amount of disruption in the community. And I think, you know, there does need to be a discussion about race, and there does need to be a discussion about racism in America. I know from our side, you know, I'm gleefully enjoying the discussion that Senator Paul and Governor Perry are leading on our side. But I do think, you know, both sides do need to come together and discuss race and racism and structural racism within America, and not from a gotcha perspective. It can't be used as a tool of hey, I got you here, so now, you know, come along with this program or come along with this policy. But I do think a discussion needs to take place.
So let me begin this discussion. I'm going to open the phones here. So I'm going to come back from break. And my old friend Doc Cheatham is the first caller up. We'll go to Doc. 410-319-8888. Please join us here. But I would like to tackle the question of each one by piece here. The police, housing, question of jobs, and our education system. So when we talk about the reformation of our policing system, what is that? What form does that take? I think one of the things people have a difficult time doing is kind of putting their hands concretely around what changes need to happen. And it'll be a huge political battle, even if you lay out the first thing being a police civilian review board that actually has investigatory powers and some teeth to address things going on. But I mean, so what does that mean to reform the police?
Can I jump in first here?
Please go ahead,
Jim. Yeah, I think the very first thing should be a citizen review board with power to recommend charges to the state's attorney. But within that, you need to have one thing. You know, I've been having some discussions around, you know, what a good citizen review board looks like, especially for Baltimore City. The number one thing that the board would need are strong, thorough investigators. You know, you can't just clap together. Thorough, not federal, but thorough.
Oh, thorough.
You
know, thorough. I'm sorry.
Investigators that you know can do the due diligence. You know, one of the issues that you know, we're seeing right now is that the investigators can't do the strong due diligence to present the hard facts to the state's attorney to recommend charges. Secondly, I think policy and procedures within police departments needs to be treated on the same level as law. Policies and procedures are put in place for the same reason that laws are passed when dealing with police, and that's to protect the individual liberty of the citizens. And, you know, if, you know, while a police officer may not necessarily break the law, you know, you can still have your rights violated with them violating police procedure. And I feel as though that same level of weight of breaking the law should be carried with breaking police procedure.
If we start with the Citizen Review Board, I think we're misguided.
What do you mean?
In reform. What it means is we're trying to put citizen review in place to be a buffer within an already dysfunctional system. We got to go all the way back to the philosophy behind policing and how it is used as a way of geographic control to keep certain folks in certain places so that they don't end up in other places. We got to go back to the root of how policing was done, because it is really not just people management, but it's spatial management, right? So policing in a harbor looks a little different than policing in the Western District, right? So we got to look at this notion. If policing is there to protect the liberty of the citizens, then we have to go back and understand the perception around who do we see as citizens. It goes deeply to the core of the issue of race, and it goes all the way back to this sustained, repeated issue upheld by law going all the way back to Dred Scott, is that black folks couldn't be citizens. They could only be property. That's the root. That ends up being the practice of law until it's superseded by Plessy. That's modified a little bit until you get to Brown v. Board. So we have embedded in the structure of the United States a behavior that says, I'm going to look at people of color as non-citizen first, which means I'm not protecting their liberty. I'm controlling their behavior and managing where they go. And until we get this notion that people of color have a right, a citizen's right to participate in the fabric of the society, and that the police have a responsibility to protect those rights, we're going to find ourselves trying to put in citizen. We got to put it in now because the structure is dysfunctional, so you can't leave it as it is. Do it now, but go back to the root cause and retrain officers to say, if protecting liberty is what you're supposed to do, then that requires a different set of tactics.
So we got a break here now. Because I, yes. So one more quick thought before we go to break here, then, Kimberly. Then you go to break and go to the phones. I mean, so that, and then concretely, following up, Todd, what you were saying, what does that mean?
Yeah.
I mean, where do we take that, and how do we and how do we use that to really begin to change the conversation and not just the conversation, but the internal workings of the police department, and how the law is entrusted with them, completely. You know, so that. So where do we take that?
Yeah, I think it. I concur with everything that has been said and thought. I have no additional piece to contribute to exactly what was just said, other than the fact that for me, a lot of this becomes about a focus on the adults, and I always want to bring the conversation back to children and making sure that we're thinking about our future generations and not just where we are in present day, because we have a tendency to focus on the now in terms of where we are and how we are being directly affected by what is going on in the police department or educate, wherever it is, housing, et cetera, when I think oftentimes we leave out the very folks that we need to be focused on, which are the children. And so if we're having the conversations about what needs to happen in the police department or housing or education, where judicial system, there needs to be a focus that thinks about our future generations and our children. So what are the police doing to make those connections with our young folks so that they grow up understanding and still thinking, believing in the philosophy or the notion of officer friendly, which is long gone in Baltimore City, but taking us back to that instead of this idea of controlling or managing or containing. And I think if we have the focus on the children first, then that starts to really impose what we should be doing in these current structures that benefit them, which then also benefits us as adults.
We'll take a quick break, and I'm going to come back and really come pursue this and also move on to housing and education issues that we're being affected by, and where we take all these things that are in the headlines and what goes under them. On our way to break, it's Tecumseh Valley. Nancy Griffith. She was born on this day in 1954. Maryland's own. Happy birthday, Nancy Griffith. We'll be right back.
Sunshine, walk beside you. She came for Spencer.
Higher and higher. Jackie Wilson came out in this day in 1965, and that's the theme of this conversation today. How do we take it higher and higher with our guests, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, the Reverend Todd Geary, and Gene Craig III? I like the third part in your name. 410-319-8888 is the number. As I promised, we'll go right to the phones. Doc Cheatham, you're on the air. Welcome, Doc.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Mark. And great guest you have there today. And
thank
let
you.
Me hasten to apologize that we thought we had been sending you emails to markbstein@gmail.com.
That's my personal address. You got it, right?
That's the one we sent to you with reference to the rally we had dealing with the Lee Jackson statue.
Yes.
We did send it to you because your show that you
put
on it was outstanding. You did get it.
Yes.
Okay. The reason I called is I think your guests are very much on point. One of the things we're hoping to do is rather than continue to have just these discussions throughout Sandtown, Winchester, and Holland Park, is to take it to the next level. There have been two extensive reports written about the disparities of these three communities. They were done by Johns Hopkins and the Health Department. One was in 2008. The other was in 2011. Sadly enough, there has been no effort to address the problems that were reflected in these two reports. So on August the 1st, a number of us in these three communities are coming together to address the socioeconomic characteristics and problems in these communities, the education shortcomings, the community problems, the environmental problems, the housing problems. Each one of the areas that are outlined in these two reports, we are going to address them and come up with some solutions on August the 1st at the Waxner Center. And we would love to have all of you come and participate, because just having the dialogue is not getting us anywhere. These reports are almost 8 years old, but no one has addressed these disparities.
Doc, thanks so much. And maybe we'll, as we approach that date, we'll get you and some others on to talk about that and put that conversation here so people can be part of that and move to that place. And I did see your piece on the Confederate statues, which we're talking about. But so I mean, I think that goes to the – come back to – before we go to Michael and Leroy, our next two callers up, it kind of brings me back to where we left off, which is when you said I'm pointing to you, Todd, here, excuse me, that when you said, Todd, that Civilian Review Board may be the wrong place to start. So I'm not quite sure, but then you kind of gave a very powerful litany of the history of what brought us here. So what does that mean about where we start then?
Well, it's the place where we're left to start, but we cannot make that the total focus of the solution. The goal would actually be to restructure the notion of policing so that citizens' review boards' work is really rather limited. We're trying to use citizen review as a fix for structural deficiencies in policing that the review, the word review means it's after the fact.
Correct.
There is no
right.
preemptive
right.
work
right.
that allows us to mitigate for some of these things. So we've got to look at the structure. While you have citizen review in place now, at the same time, let's look at the structure of policing and how we approach policing.
So, I mean, this is an important point. I want to raise this to our listeners and to people on this panel, what you were just saying, Todd. So we're talking about, and it's true, civilian review boards are after the fact. An incident takes place, the situation is reviewed, and an officer has either dealt with it, did something incorrectly, or said, no, he was fine, and you create this community conversation and all the rest. So that's a fact. That could be a fact. So what does it mean, then, to alter the inherent philosophical structure of a place like the police department to unearth its current ways of dealing with the public, to change that, to change the nature of policing, which is to be to protect the property of wealth from people who have none, and in this case, to protect Baltimore from poor black people
right.
who are going to run havoc and take over and take everything you got, right? That's... So how do we begin to change that? What do you think? Where do you begin that? Not an easy question. Just want to throw it out there for a minute. I mean, we'll wrestle with this for months to come on this program. But I want to throw that out there because I think that is a piece of what we have to do here.
I think it has to be move from a us. I think it has to move from a us versus them mentality. The mentality of that everyone is guilty until proven innocent, sort of. When you're having an encounter with the police, I mean. Over 80% of the police encounters are going to be negative in any jurisdiction. I mean, it's going to be your traffic stops. It's going to be your, you know, what are you up to, you know, encounters. But if you move from we're here reacting to something negative to, you know, we're a part of this community, you know, we're here to build on something positive, build on positive interactions, I think we could move there. But, this still has to be defined.
I can give you an example real quick.
So go ahead.
I went on during my leadership class year, we did ride-alongs. I did a ride-along in Western District with one of the officers, and he just shared with me how frustrated he was that the evaluation of his performance was tied less to service calls and more to the numbers of arrests. So if the quality of your job is tied to how many people you lock up, it
right.
changes then
right.
the frame of reference you use once you get a call, right? I'm not here to protect and serve. I'm here to go get bad guys. So whoever I go, wherever I'm sent, I'm looking for the bad guy in the scenario so that then I can do my job and get credit for doing my job. And if I don't have a bad guy, I can find a bad guy in the scenario because otherwise it's a wasted call. So we got to retrain. We've got to retrain all the way in the system from your line officers to your supervisors to your command staff. And that could be a front-end conversation that police community relations are put in the front end of the
right,
training
right,
along
right, yeah.
with citizen review as part of that framework so that we're not afraid of the people we're trying to serve.
There was a lieutenant on this program just a few weeks back, last month, who is head of the Vanguard Justice Society, police lieutenant, who said basically that the police only do what they're told. Tell us to do something different and we'll start figuring out how to change the culture. and because we are told to arrest people, it's coming, even though they're not going to put it on a black and white piece of paper saying arrest as many people. That's the understanding we have coming down from our commanders, what our guys in the street feel every day. And so that is part of where this has to change. And that,
which is also tied to the politics of it all, right?
Right,
because even
right.
though it may be coming from the commissioner on down, you also have to think about who is in office that is saying this is the way that we want to do it. So, I mean, let's think about probably around the time the Reverend was doing his ride-alongs may have coincided with Martin O'Malley being in office as mayor. And we know what we saw happen in terms of numbers of arrests during his time frame. And so we've got to think about it doesn't even reside just within the police department, because depending on someone's politics and what they believe needs to happen to show that the city is moving forward and progressing, that it's even our elected officials and it doesn't just reside in one particular spot.
And I would say that it resides probably more with the elected than the police department. You know, your police commissioner answers to your mayor and he answers to your city council.
Yeah, except it takes a lot to unroot that behavior inside.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's part of what has to happen. And part of the problem is that there are a lot of people, officers, black, white, Latino, whoever they may be, see young black people and black people in general in the street as somebody who has to be confronted and questioned as opposed—
And contained.
And contained.
In the system of policing, let's be fair. Understand that Commissioner Batts— is relatively new to the position. The structural issues actually precede his tenure.
By a couple hundred years.
Yeah, right. So you can change all of the elected officials that you want to. If you're telling me that over the course of a couple of hundred years, we couldn't find one elected official that could change the mindset, the structure of policing is tied in its core to racially keep folks in their place. And until you change that structure and that mindset, you're going to keep having the same kinds of outcomes.
I'm going to get a couple callers in here, but then I'm going to kind of switch gears to all this news about housing and how that fits in this conversation as well, because I think the things we're seeing here also are part of this larger structure that has to be confronted. And maybe that this is the political movement building towards this next session. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air. Line one.
As is made plain by looking at videos of some of these confrontations between African Americans and the police that come to try to get order in disorderly situations, one can see that there's an implicit bias on the side of those in the community against the police. And what I would propose is that there be more arresting of those people who interfere with the police doing their job. They should be arrested right on the spot, because police should be respected and not interfered with when they're doing their work. Not only that, but as far as the cameras are concerned, that will only make the problems worse, because it'll inhibit the behavior of the police. They'll be afraid that they may make a wrong reaction, and that'll be caught on tape, and then they have to go before a board. So none of that should happen. The problem is that things have changed so much. There's been a sea change. Flash mobs. What are police supposed to do in that case when they come to help out a poor store owner? What about black-on-white racism, like the knockout game, where we have many, many instances of these all over the country and are almost never reported on? What's going on in the African-American community that they have such a disrespect, disregard, and hatred toward the police, that the police can't be protecting the citizenry who need the protection because of what the black population does to stop them?
Okay,
Michael, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to jump in here. You know, first, when it comes to body cameras and video cameras, they protect good police. They protect good police actions. You know, a good police officer is not afraid of a body camera or a video camera because they know it will vindicate their action when the action is properly taken. And Michael, you know, I can say this as a young black Republican. The basis of your argument here that the black youth are out of control, that the citizenry has to be protected from the black youth, is what is at the core of this issue. It's what's at the core of this issue. I mean, it's what's inflaming the tension between, you know, the black community and the policing. I mean, you don't just wipe away, you know, 150, you know, 200 years of negative encounter with government and then, you know, just say and then blame it on the person that's reacting. I mean, it doesn't – life doesn't work that way.
There are two things going simultaneously. One, you got to love freedom of speech. Two, I'm always amazed at revisionist history. That one of the reasons we have a lot of folks filming police encounters is because we found out in the filming of those police encounters, when you try to reconcile what's on the video with what's in the report, very often what was in the report written by the police officer was so far from what was actually on the video that now you have rising distrust that then feeds that kind of protectionist mindset that when the people that are supposed to protect and serve, I now must defend against, it then creates those kinds of scenarios. So I think in a way I hear Michael's concern, but he's actually making the point that the reason you have this is because here's what we do. We use tax dollars, of which black people do pay some, to buy weapons, police cars, uniforms, pay salaries, all of those things. So there is an interest that all people actually have in this process to expect the police to come in with the notion that you're to protect and serve as part of their mission. To think somehow that is asking too much of them is absolutely crazy. They're not going up on every scene to just go get a bad guy. I think that's the thing that we dismiss. And so we got to go back and look at that. I think it's showing up in the public perception, and it's tragic because that's the way policing has been done.
Yeah, yep. And Michael also makes a point of using the same language that I used to make my earlier point about a level of implicit bias. And based on that implicit bias, it has created a friction between citizens and police departments in ways that has created exactly where we are right now in terms of this level of distrust and not being comfortable to engage one another. And I also think it's important to think about because the incidents that get popularized or sensationalized by media are the ones that immediately show that the victim or the so-called victim that is being attacked or approached by police isn't a perfect victim. They've got something in their history that then allows us to create a narrative that they are then under the direction of why police respond the way that they do. And so I think it's important for us to think about the number. I mean, if I can sit around as a woman, a black woman with a PhD, in circles with most black people who have PhDs, and we can still share stories, common stories, of black men being approached or harassed by police officers, you've got to think that this is not something that is applicable to just one segment of the population. And so it's real, and it is pervasive, and it carries out through our community in ways that is not just targeted towards a few, but there are a number who are impacted by this.
Very important.
You know,
I'm going to jump to the phones.
I'm going to jump in real quick. One more point. There was an interesting article in Politico about a month and a half ago. Politico reporter sat down with seven D.C. school kids, middle school kids, ages from range 11 to 13. And, you know, you want to know where the attitudes, where the bias, where the distrust starts? Right there. I mean, when you have middle schoolers that can give you stories about banger units, that can give you stories about, you know, police jump outs, that can give you stories about being thrown up against the wall, you know, for simply standing outside with five or six other, you know, young black kids, you know, that's where the distrust for the police starts.
And we had that same conversation on this show just last month with four young African-American students in public schools here in Baltimore, who shared their stories about police, and all of them shared stories about either they or their close friends or their brother or sister had been stopped, thrown against the wall, frisked, put in a police car, handcuffed, when they hadn't done anything. They were just walking down the street. And I think
because of implicit bias.
Yes, right. So you hear these young people tell these stories, you know, and
they're not making it up. I actually have someone that works with me at the church who works in law enforcement full time was talking about their son going out and giving instructions that, look, when you go out, if you get stopped, this is what you do. Here was the pretext. There's a taillight out that necessitates the stop. the quote-unquote smell of marijuana necessitates the search. Now, if a reasonable officer, quote-unquote, says they think they smell marijuana, that's all the pretext they need to be able to pull you out and do all of that other kind of stuff. They don't have to know marijuana's in the car. They don't have to see the marijuana in the car. That's one of the major issues that we've got that gets a lot of young kids in these scenarios with police officers, because we create these unreasonable pretexts that give officers the opportunity to shake them down. Here's how her son got out of a scenario. When the stop happened, they're sitting on the side, they're searching the car, they're waiting on a backup. Finally, he lets one of the officers know that he has a parent who works in law enforcement who had given them specific instruction, and here's what he did. He said, look, I'm not doing anything else. I want to see my lawyer. So now when you start bringing in an outside observer that knows the rules and can protect the rights, now you have to go back and play the game the way the game is supposed to be played. What we have is we have an unfair set of rules that allow some, and we're not talking about all police officers, but as we would say in some traditions, a little leaven leavens the whole loaf. You don't need a lot of toxin. If you have a little poison, it'll kill you. It'll just take a little longer to get there. And so until we start getting it out of the system and making the system accountable for helping to protect its own image and the integrity of the work that they do, we're going to keep having these conversations. Let's stop playing these games where we allow some officers, not all, but some officers do what they do. We saw a piece not too long ago about an officer that came out, tried to make an anonymous complaint about an officer that they saw violating the rights of a citizen. Somehow or another, they found out exactly who he was, went after him with a vengeance, mm-hmm. where he actually had to leave the department,
right.
and left the department because they found a way to fire him. Mm-hmm. So we got to look at all of this as part of this systemic issue, the structural issue. Citizens review boards, put them in place. But until we get ahead of the curve and begin to remove the officers that are contributing to this cause, we are just fighting an uphill battle.
410-319-8888. Leroy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Tickle Pink, I love your panel this morning.
Thank you.
I've never heard the conversation go in such depth before as what it's doing today. I most of the stuff that I had called about, your panel had just recently touched base on it, like the mind changing the mindset, or maybe start a new administration changing the administration's mindset and working now, because the officers only do what they're told to do. So, it starts there. And it's not all officers. There was officers in Western District. I don't know whatever happened to Officer Martin and some of the other guys. I don't know the other names, but they started out by treating us like human beings first. And I just have to commend some of the officers. They are human beings and treating us like human beings. But your panel touched on so much that I wanted to talk about, and it's talking about changing the mindset and also protecting, willing to be part of the solution. And that's what I hear your panel talking about, and that's what I'm loving. My dad used to tell me, why complain about the problem if you're not willing to be part of the solution, as a kid growing up? And that's what we do all the time. I just wish if your panels can't visit our church, give us a place where y'all meet, and I can bring young men and young women around there and hear a lot of the stuff that you know. Because there are a lot of young kids that want change. Some of them just don't know how. They have to be taught.
Right. Look, that's really a very important piece. Change does not come without kind of a committed organizing and bringing people in to learn and have experiences heard and learn from that, how to handle that and where to take that politically and socially. I think that's a very key. It's key to all of this. Organizing is the most important key, I think, to all of this. Let me switch gears for a moment, if I might. As we look at this, one of the other issues facing the city is housing and a housing crisis. A housing crisis for people who have fewer economic means than most people sitting at this table do. And how we wrestle with that. My friend Jeff Singer from Healthcare for the Homeless, who founded that organization, mm-hmm. comes up with the statistic that he did the study where 86,000 families are home insecure. I use that all the time. So I want that drummed into the consciousness that exists. That is probably half the people of Baltimore City living in poverty, in the great depths of poverty in the city. And so we see $28 million being cut from a federal housing program to Baltimore, perhaps. And that's being debated and fought, but it looks like it's going to be cut. People cannot afford housing in this city. We saw now that Perkins Homes is going to be laid waste at some point. 600 families being removed. But we don't know what that means. And matter of fact, when they had the community meeting about that, what I was told by people at Perkins Homes on Friday was that somebody tacked up at 3 o'clock a notice saying this is a 6 o'clock meeting to talk about Perkins Homes that they had been talking about before even talking to the people in that place. And I'll tell you a very quick story that about 3 months ago, 4 months ago, whatever, it was a while back, I was speaking to a group that works with young men who go to a high school in Baltimore, and these young men and women, and have created a program that allows them to actually end up in college and build lives. And it's a good program, and there are many good programs like that. So I was talking to them, and while I was there, I was at a high-rise in the East Harbor. And we were on the very top floor of this high-rise, and I was in this room waiting for the thing to start, talking to a gentleman who is one of the leaders of that whatever organization had this room at this high-rise, and looking out over the east. And pointed down to this place in outside the window, saying down there, that's the problem. That has to be removed. And when that happens, when that's removed, then the harbor can meet Hopkins. And I said, what are you pointing to? And that place there, I said, that's Perkins Homes. There are thousands of people living there. What do you mean they're the problem that has to be removed? So when I saw the news the other day, roaring back to me, realizing that this has been a plan, and people are never part of the plan. Plans are made for people, but people are never part of the plan being made for them or part of the discussion about where they want to go, how they change things, and how you build interracial, inter-socioeconomic communities where people live together as opposed to people who are being moved out. And that's a fundamental flaw in leadership of how you run a city.
Agreed.
So what do you do about that? We have to take a break right now. Yes, just saying, take a boat. That's where I'm leaving. Picking up right after the news. After the news break. And we'll pick right up. 410-319-8888. We're going to get to your calls coming in, your thoughts on that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Use the answer and fool them. Love. Sounds to really make you rub and scrub. Sounds for them when I'm going to leave my middle bum. Bum, believe it, leave it, leave it, leave it, leave it, leave bum. I said,
pass the Dutchy on the left hand side. Pass the Dutchy on the left hand side. It's a go bun.
Give me the music, make me jump and fall.
It's a go bun.
Just wanna chill and catch stunts in my 745. You drive me crazy, shorty. I need to see you and feel you next to me. I provide everything you need, and I like your smile.
I'm Mark Steiner. That's 50 Cent. 21 Questions. He was born on this day in 1975 and went to break. I didn't tell you all, was Past the Dutchie by musical youth. Michael Grant of the group was born today in 1969. So happy birthday to both of them. And we are back here with our guests remaining in this panel. We're going to pick up the theme here, 410-319-8888, with the Reverend Todd Yeary, Senior Pastor of the Douglas Memorial Church, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, Eugene Craig III, a grassroots activist who is also third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party, and you at 410-319-8888. So we left off talking about the housing issue and just went through a litany of things that are going on. And to add to that, that when we look at the RAD program, which some people are calling privatization of public housing, there's no real serious discussion within the halls of power about the notion of community land trusts, where people from those communities could actually own the buildings themselves and control that property. So it's theirs, and we move ahead with a different economic and housing model. So how do we get to this point? Something has to be pushed here to change. We can't allow just the very fact the federal government is cutting back on funding for housing to end our ability to think creatively about how to house people in the city.
So I want to interject very quickly to respond to something you left us with at the before the break. And for me, I'm outing myself now as someone who has only been in Baltimore for the last 10 years, but as someone who always makes a point of becoming engaged in whatever community she's in, I've done so since I got here. And one of the things that I've always observed about Baltimore, and hopefully the hate mail won't start, is that it seems to me to be this very consistent strategy of politics in the city where we view, in particular, since we do have a significant number of working class and poor families in the city, that the way that we do politics or that we govern bodies in this city is a very paternalistic way of they don't know any better or they don't necessarily have the skill set in order to do what needs to be done, so we have to do it for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's consistent to what I've seen certainly in my capacity in the education system in this city where, again, it's not uncommon to hear about notices being tacked up just a few hours before something is to occur. But not only that, not just in terms of alerting the citizenry, but the fact that when you do come to the table, it seems like everything has already been done, that it's already been created for you to say, look at what we've done, and this is how we want to make it happen, and just to make the citizenry happy with what has already been done instead of having the citizenry at the table from the very beginning to play a role in what is to be the future of the city.
That does happen here all the time, and I think this is we're at a moment where that might be able to shift, maybe not.
Well, I think one of the descriptive words that was implied when you were up in the high rise and we got to get rid of that. The that is really a them.
Yes, yes. Yes.
That's tied to
yes.
a geographic space. And so we really want to say let's get rid of them. Let's say let's get rid of that because it is less politically challenging. The them are poor people.
Right.
So poor people are often left out because for whatever reason, we make poor synonymous with a whole lot of stuff, right? Freddie Gray was poor. And black. Ran into some challenges early on with housing issues in his own narrative, in his own story, that certainly could have played and probably did play some role in some of his later experiences. When we look at the clustering of people when you were trying to get labor forces in place, the evolution of public housing, there was a need. Now that you don't have the labor opportunities for folks to be able to get the jobs, now let's get rid of the folks because all they're doing is they're taking our money, they're using up space. And now that we've gotten what we wanted, which we couldn't include them in the establishment and the rationale for the zoning, but we could use their circumstances to help justify why we needed to be able to leverage public dollars to do some of the development that's going on down there. And since we don't need them anymore, let's get rid of that, but the that is a them. And so until we start personalizing the plight of poor people, when you have a state that ranks near the top, one in median income, but the city comes in at about 40th, if it were a state on its own, $45,000 median income in the city. But there are neighborhoods, the neighborhood just inside the boundary. You go across Utah, you're in Bolton Hill, different reality. You cross and you come up in Upton Druid Heights, median income, $12,000 a year. Until we deal
that
with
number one more time.
$12,000 a year. Until we deal with the economic plight of poor people. And start addressing it. These are folks who have personhood. One of your callers said these are people. You know, imagine how tragic it is when we consider it a novel idea that police, policymakers treat poor people, people of color, like they're human beings. Isn't that a neat idea? Let's get back to the reality that until we address the issues, one of the texts that I wrestle with in my vocation, when the rabbi says the poor shall always be among you, I don't think that was an indictment on poor people. It would say that the system has to find the courage to be able to address these issues. And I think the co-op is real. Use the vouchers to be able to transfer the ownership, build equity so that then they
right.
have the owner has a different mindset than the person that's just renting because their plight right is more dubious in the process. So we gotta wrestle with that. We gotta call it out for what it is. And there's something unfair that would say we would use the conditions of the poor people in Perkins homes to be able to get Harbor Point developed with consideration of dollars because it allowed to revise. You were able to revise the application to make it an enterprise zone. Now that you've done it and you've gotten the allocation of the funds, we don't need them anymore. Let's move them out. Until we call it what it is, that is hypocrisy at its highest level. We're going to continue to wrestle with that. And it is not tied to personalities. It's tied to policies. We got to get to the policies so that when the elections come up, who's going to have the agenda that's going to deal with the structural policy issues, not who you like, not who you think you like, who's going to make sure you have a seat at the table and your interests are going to be represented so that we don't keep dealing with it.
Because a seat at the table is a big piece of what we're talking about here, is what we really mean by democracy and how much we include people in that democratic process. And that one thing is we raised here about the community land trust, the reason I raised it is because I've been reading and thinking a lot about the role of cooperative businesses as a way to help people out of poverty by owning things themselves collectively, like they do in Cleveland and other places where there's this, where those things are working in poor communities. That could change the way we do stuff here. I mean, that's what we have to think about because we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again. We're not dealing with poverty, nor sense of community, nor building participation. Because I think powers to be, Kimberly, are afraid of that participation. You know, it's easy. It's uncomfortable. I'm going to put this out here. It's uncomfortable for many people of means and power to sit with poor people and have a conversation.
But we're all in the same community.
Right. But
so we got to live in the same community. So there does need to be a seat at the table for all of those individuals to play a part in what's going to happen. Instead of taking the perspective of, I need to do this for you because you don't know any better.
Yeah.
So let me do it for you. I mean, again, looking at the Perkins home situation, the fact that they talked, the Sun article talked about, you know, the consultants, the architects, you know, the construction company, all of these people are sitting at the table already.
Right.
And Perkins residents are just learning what is to be the demise of their homes, and they now are being asked to be at the table. So let me shine it up for you and make it look good. We did the same thing with the school system. I know I keep coming back to that, but we did the same thing with the 21st Century Plan. Let's shine it up for you and show you what good can come out of this, and that gets you on board to support the initiatives that are happening in the city.
By the way, before you jump in, I'll just say that there was an update from City Paper this morning was shown to me because they're the ones who broke the story the other day. And OSI was named in there as being one of the organizations at the table. Diana Morris of OSI, director of Open Society Institute Baltimore, wrote in saying that we were not part of that discussion. We were not in that organization. The only way we were in there was because of their criminal justice director, Tara Huffman, was in conversations about criminal justice issues and housing when he was speaking to that group, but they were not part of it, so they wanted their name taken out, saying we had nothing to do with this, which I thought I'd put that out there for them so they were not painted with the same broad brush anyway.
That's another show.
There needs to be a discussion about poverty in this country. Poverty is a real issue. You know, it affects real people and real families. And I do agree with Kimberly in the thought that, you know, Baltimore is run largely from a paternalistic, we know better, you know, we know what you need. But, you know, in all honesty, you know, you cannot honestly, genuinely help a person without having a conversation about them to understand their need. Everybody does not have the same cookie-cutter needs. You know, my needs are not the same needs as Kimberly has, and her needs are not the same needs as yours, Mark. But, you know, I do think, you know, we do need to look at the policy. I'm not a fan of collective ownership. You know, just typically doesn't work that well because nobody truly takes a full ownership stake in it. And so then the pride that normally would need to go into an enterprise because of the ownership stake that's there, you know, you typically don't see with collective ownership. But what I do
– we have that debate another day.
But what I do believe is this. If a development is going to come into a community under the auspices of enterprise zone or of, you know, we're going to come in and get this grant, this government subsidy, which I'm firmly against, by the way, to build here, It should be under the auspice that we're going to come here to help provide economic opportunity. You know, it's pointless for you know, a government, you know, state level, state, local, or federal to come in and provide a subsidy if it doesn't benefit the community that's there. You know, if it's not creating an economic opportunity. I mean, that's the point of it. And you know, so I kind of take offense to, you know, the removing of that myself, because, you know, it's, you know, as a taxpayer, you know, if you're going to use tax dollars to develop, you know, it better develop, you know, better provide opportunity for those that you're in the area and community that you're developing in.
So, this calls for it seems to me, a kind of conversation we're not having. Changing the way people – now, we can agree or disagree about federal money, which I think is part of the debate, and I would be on the side saying we need more funds, but it depends on how they're used and whether they're used democratically and for and with and for people, as opposed to just for a few folks to make a lot of money. But again, this is part of pushing a change in how things are discussed and even analyzed in the halls of power. And our role there.
That's always the big discussion about political engagement. A lot of times folks in affected communities that have been disenfranchised are encouraged to vote, as if voting is the sole remedy to their issues. It's part of the remedy. It engages. It puts your wishes in as part of the public discussion about who's going to advocate on your behalf. But once the voting's done, you got to stay engaged in the policy discussions. And one of the things that has happened, excuse me, is that communities that have become frustrated are now totally disengaged, which then leaves the opportunity to say, all right, we'll put this up now because they're not coming anyway. And once we say we've checked that box, we can at least say we tried, so that we can go ahead and move forward with the issue at hand. The thing that we also have to remember about federal subsidies is, let's not lose sight of the fact that Maryland does not support its own economic viability off of its own coffers. If you didn't get almost 50% of the state budget by way of federal consideration, you don't have a viable state that is able to claim the rank around its schools statewide or its economic potential statewide. So what we have to now do is say we got to tie the allocation of federal funds and make sure it drills down to benefit the folks that are most adversely affected in the neighborhoods where we're going to spend those dollars. Right now, the Department of Transportation has a pilot project that federal dollars used for transportation projects must carry with it a consideration for local hiring. It's a one-year pilot, very similar to Section 3 under HUD. That ought to be across every cabinet department. Why? Because the next major economic driver in this area is going to be the expansion of the port. Maersk just came out with the announcement that they're reconnecting.
That's right.
That's going to be a huge economic driver. But if we don't if we don't have the assurance that as the jobs come online, it's going to benefit local residents that need to be tied to the benefit of the economy as it's expanding, then we're going to continue to have these conversations. Once we get what we need from them or that, let's move that out of the way so we don't have to see that anymore. We've got to make it's a policy conversation. We got to drill down. You got to include the community. But those who are in the conversation, advocacy groups, you got to push this thing. Do not give elected officials, any of them, a pass. Once we make decisions that are going to change the economic viability, what's the backup plan? You just can't say no. What's next? If this isn't the way to move forward, what's the idea that's going to move us forward? We cannot just have this kind of random, wanton pulling back of things that are designed, at least intended, to benefit the community, have those conversations, and then have them pulled, i.e., transportation infrastructure in Baltimore City. That's a huge deal. And no one's really come back. We don't have a backup plan. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Oh, yes.
Just say no with no backup plan.
That's a problem.
And it is. And I think that's what I mean by connecting the dots. And somehow, for me, programs like this and stuff that we do in the community have to connect those dots to make things change and work. You know, I mean, because the men and women who worked on the longshore, the men and the people who helped build the middle class in this country came from places like Perkins Homes and worked in those docks and made the money with places like Maersk coming back in. Yeah. And also we're not preparing them in our schools for those kinds of jobs to prepare what you have to do in the increased computerization of the work on the docks. That is less and less done by men lifting heavy stuff than by men pushing buttons to move heavy stuff, right?
Here's a scary consideration around an opportunity. I was talking to a vice president from Boeing at a conference. Boeing Corporation has the potential of losing about 50% of its technical workforce over the next 5 years to retirement. There is no pipeline to replace those jobs. Many of those jobs are STEM-related, tied to robotics. We haven't started thinking about projecting out where are going to be the job opportunities so that we're not just hoping on a whim that some isolated project is going to be the salvation of our community, which means then we got to get the superintendent in the room with all of the resources to say, let's change the profile. If mandatory compulsory education is going to move from 16 to 18, that law gets to be implemented now. If they're going to be there till 18, if they're going to be there at 18, let's change the profile of how we do public education and have them not just graduate with a high school diploma, but at least get them to the associate's degree so that they come out with an opportunity to go right into the workforce with a credential that's going to allow them to change the upside of their future.
I think that Leon Botstein is president of Bard College, and I've known him for a long time. He was president of the college I was in many, many, many years back. I was a very young man. We were both very young men. But I say that one of the things, interesting article he wrote was that high schools, the way they're structured now, have outlived their usefulness in education. And if someone developing this kind of idea, this is critically important. I think that everybody thinks you have to go to a four-year college to make a living or lead a decent life, and you don't.
Although I like that idea.
Huh? No, I think kids want to get a four-year college. My youngest daughter's getting ready to go to college, and she's going to go to a four-year college and getting into writing and philosophy, and that's who she is and what she wants to do. And God bless her. Go do it, girl.
Right.
You know? But everybody's not studying philosophy and writing.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you're less or more or less of a human being if you do or don't study philosophy or writing. But somebody's got to fix that HVAC system out there and make $80,000 a year.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't that be a kid from Perkins Homes?
Absolutely.
When a school that actually gets him to the AA degree that Todd's talking about to get him the degree to be able to fix those systems to make them work.
Well, and I think you're right that Bard is at the table for making something like that happen, and the fact that they are one of the schools that we'll see open up this fall.
That's
in
right.
The
that's
city.
Right. I forgot about that.
Yes,
that's right.
They have been very successful in other parts of the country, including New Orleans and New York, and now we see them here in our backyard. And hopefully, we'll see some of those conversations change that people recognize that we do need to jumpstart the opportunities for our young people.
But I think it has to be done without the privatization of our schools by large corporations in America. You can't destroy the public school system in the process.
Absolutely.
Which is part of the game taking place.
Because some folks are not going to be able to escape it. Some folks are going to get trapped. They're going to be left with under-resourced public education as the only alternative they have. And those who can get out will get out. We've got to make sure that public education works effectively for those who will utilize it and make sure that they're coming out with opportunities that will allow them to live productive lives.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, though, I mean, even in the Bard situation, that is a public school. So we're talking about private organizations that are coming to the table to work with public schools to make something like this happen. And so it's important to make sure we create that distinction that we don't
see these
private organizations coming in and privatizing education, but in fact being partners at the table.
I don't believe that for-profit organizations should be allowed to come in and take over schools. That's why I don't believe.
I think you should. We do have to protect public education, but at the same time, I think we need more choice and competition within public education.
Let's get a couple quick calls in here before the end of our conversation. 410-319-8888. We'll go to Jason West on the west side. You're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
One issue I would say about public education in general is that our country is lost its way when it comes to education.
Jason, we're having a hard time hearing you, brother, because you're in a zone where your cell phone's not coming through very clear. I'm sorry. You still there?
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Go ahead. Try again.
I I just want to say we really, really don't know why we're educating kids. You know, are we educating kids for a job? Are we educating kids to be a citizen?
Jason, try to call back. We'll try to get you back in because they're just yourself, yeah. Wherever you are, the reception's not working. I apologize. I want to hear what you were saying. 410-319-8888. Nathaniel, is it? On line one, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Thank Good morning, you Nathaniel.
How you doing? Good.
Very well. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm from West Baltimore. I moved back here about 3 years ago from Chicago. I'm born and raised in Baltimore. I've been 15 years in Chicago. Went to Chicago, got hired on a Class 1 railroad. I want to go back to the comment that John made about companies losing workforce to retirement. It's the same thing on the railroad. In the next 4 to 5 years, they lose 30-35% of their workforce. Now, I've been trying to implement a program here Boys and Men in Training, to try to get young boys 13 to 17 years old to start showing them the things that I do as a mechanical inspector on the railroad. These jobs are there. They start at, you know, $29 to $35 an hour. I've given proposals to two churches and also the thing on Monroe Street. I can't think of families.
Center for Urban Families.
Center for Urban Families, yeah.
Yes, yes. I've given them a proposal for the idea. I'm just not getting any feedback. And I figured with what happened, you know, over the last month, you know, I'd get some help with it. I mean, because the jobs are there. And I especially asked for it in West Baltimore a year ago. It's been 6 years since I've been trying to get this started. But
are you still working for the railroad?
Yeah, I work on the railroad. I've been in the railroad for 12 years. I'm a mechanical inspector, like I say, with a Class 1 railroad, the biggest in the city. We all know who it is. And I can't get any help. If there's anybody or if you can point me in a direction, because well, I know this program will work.
Well, don't hang up. We can get your phone number and connect you. And Todd Shingen said, yes, Adieri, so we'll get you connected with at least one church who wants to do something. Todd, right?
I got him.
All right, so don't hang up. Our producer will get your telephone number and email. We'll give it to Todd Yeary off the air, and he'll be back in touch with you. Because I think that is part of it. I would add one thing, Nathaniel, just in terms of our future. It's not just young men and boys who take these jobs. It's all of our young people, boys and girls, young men and young women.
Absolutely.
Because women are now doing these jobs. It's not just this our old paradigm of men just doing the work is gone. So a young woman could be a mechanical inspector and make that $30 an hour. And take care of a family as well. So I just want to throw that out there, just as a thought about who we recruit and who we bring in to this new workforce of the 21st century. Because you know, that kind of sexism runs deep in our culture, as deep as racism, but not deeper in some ways. Longer standing, anyway.
Now that you've mentioned sexism, you brought up the issue of public housing. Remember that public housing was almost a punitive tool against mothers who were raising families as a way to kind of manipulate. If you go back and look early on, how access to the resource was often used as an incentive to intrude upon the family structure.
Yep.
I think Andrew Billingsley early on wrote about sitting in the parking lot of high rises, actually in Chicago, and observing while he was doing his data collection at about 2 o'clock in the morning. The men of the household would climb up the fire escape to go in and check on their families and then have to leave before five, because if the men were caught in the house, it would lead to the mother losing the benefits that were made available by way of the federal government. We got to look at the housing structure, the voucher structure, how it keeps mothers embedded in poverty, raising kids. I mean, just think about this in terms of the educational system. When you now have your school system potentially responsible for 10 of the children's meals in the course of the week, what you now have, and it's an important thing, we know the feeding is there, but the need to make sure that the kids are fed is certainly an important one. But we've got some deeply embedded structural issues, because in some instances it feels like you've got a feeding program that brings some teaching with it, as opposed to an educational program that's focusing on its mission. And if you cancel school for any reason, You now have two meals hanging in the balance for every day unless you have that system in place. What's going to be the triage to make sure that those kids are taken care of? We've got to look at the entire process. Poor people are caught in the balance there, but it's not even a rock in a hard place. It's two rocks.
That's exactly right.
And it's very, very, very troubling.
Well, this has been a great discussion. First of all, I thank the Reverend Todd Yeary here, senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Church, Eugene Craig III, who's third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. Good to have you here. Looking forward to having you back. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, associate professor of American Studies at UMBC and author of Black Berries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and a host here on the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have the three of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Discussion.
Good
to appreciate be with it. You. We're going to take a very brief break, and on our way to break, let's rip it up. Bill Haley, born on this day in 1925. We'll be right back to look at Greece and that election, what it says, and talk a bit about a convention that took place in Baltimore that most of us just have passed by, National Association of Sheriffs. What did they talk about? We're going to find out. Stay with us.
So deep in your eyes, I touch on you more and more every time. When you leave, I'm begging you not to go. Call your name 2-3 times in a row. Such a funny thing for me to try to explain.